environment and land use. Just to let the audience know, we will not be moving the bill today relating to archaeological activity, Senate Bill 64. There's a little bit more work to be done on that, so nobody hold your breath for that. And to the committee, we have heard a number of these bills before, and it's my belief that even the ones we haven't heard probably don't raise major controversies. So of course, some arise and we never expect it. So my hope is to move through this pretty quickly. Obviously, we'll let people have their say if they want it. And if we have cooperation, we can all get out here by 4 o'clock so we can get the ice cream sundaes for the governor's food drive. And with that, let's call a work session on Senate Bill 45. And if you could just give us a quick summary, committee staff, that would be great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 45 allows the Department of Environmental Quality to issue individual, general, or watershed water pollution discharge permits. It requires the department to report annually to the legislature on the administration of the permitting process and allows the department to increase fees for certain permits by a maximum of 3% per year. We do have one set of amendments that were presented to us the last time we heard this bill, and which I believe everyone was supportive of, but we didn't do the work session.
Okay, and those are the
dash ones.
The dash ones.
Okay, and what do the dash ones do?
They clarify a couple of drafting errors, essentially.
Okay, Ms. Schroeder, could you come up and just clarify what the dash ones do, please? You can, Jim, if you want to come up. We don't want to leave you back there by yourself if you don't want to be.
You might get lonesome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Holly Schroeder, and I'm the Administrator of the Water Quality Division at DEQ. Committee staff is correct. The Dash 1 amendments are simply to clarify some drafting errors and they're completely consistent with the recommendations of the committee that we worked with in preparing the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Holly, for the record, I would like you to tell us what is meant by a watershed-based approach to permitting, I think is how it is, watershed approach to water pollution control.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, thank you. That was one of the questions that came up in our first hearing on this, and pursuant to that, I did meet with Senator Beyer. What we wanted to clarify, just for the record, is that the move to a watershed-based permitting is a strategy for deployment of the overall program. It's not a change in the essence of how we would write any individual permit. In this bill, gives authority to DEQ to move to that strategy. That language is permissive, not directive, and so it's just giving us the authority to do that. And the use of that strategy allows us to employ some new tools, such as pollution trading, and those are most likely to be successful when deployed on the sub-basin watershed scale, which was one of the discussions that we talked about, and that's similar to how we do our total daily maximum loads. Again, the use of that pollution trading strategy, if we were to use that, would be voluntary. No individual permittee would be forced into a pollution trade against their will.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. If you want to step back.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair?
Whatever you'd like, Senator Atkinson.
Move the dash ones.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 45. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair. I would move the bill as amended. Suffering today.
Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Chair, I would move the bill as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
That was close, Senator Atkinson, but we need to move it to Ways and Means. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It does.
It does.
Yes, it does.
That's too bad.
Off it goes to Ways and Means. I change my motion to reflect your comments.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 45 as amended to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I was going to ask you to carry the bill, so I guess I have to send that request to Ways and Means.
Yes, you will. So let's close the work session on Senate Bill 45, and let's open a work session on Senate Bill 68.
Can we do a work session?
Okay, so we're not doing...
You want to do one?
Well, I just want to be able to put on the record what we're talking about, just so people know.
And we're not doing 64. You said that a minute ago.
I said we weren't doing 64, but right. Senator Beyer wants to at least discuss it, so we'll get there in a little bit.
Okay.
But committee staff, why don't you give us an overview of Senate Bill 68, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 68 specifies the Parks and Recreation Department may issue permits for pipelines, cable lines, and other conduits through state recreation areas. It also requires a permit to be issued by the department in order to operate a Class 1 all-terrain vehicle on the ocean shore, and allows the department to issue permits under certain specific circumstances, including to meet mobility needs of the disabled and for wildlife biologists and law enforcement rescue personnel.
Okay. And we have folks from the department here. If you could come forward, please. Thank you. Just a question. During the hearing we had last time, Senator Burdick raised an issue. Did you or somebody from your department talk with Senator Burdick about this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Wright, the Assistant Director for the Parks and Recreation Department. I think we had some correspondence with Senator Beyer, but not. I'm not aware of any with Senator
Burdick. All right. Senator Beyer, where are you on this?
Well, the question I would have about that, I guess, would be what about in the dunes areas? Or where the ATVs are down by Florence and up at Sand Lake.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, there are actually two areas on the coast where ATVs are allowed in those ocean shore areas, and that's Sand Lake Dunes and the Oregon National or Dunes National Recreation Area. Outside of that, there are prohibitions to anything other than street legal vehicles on the ocean shore.
But that didn't ask my question. Does this change that?
Chair, Senator Beyer, no, it doesn't.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, we are in a work session on Senate Bill 68. Is there a motion, Senator Atkinson?
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 68 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 68 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, do you want to carry that?
Oh, not really, but...
Not really? I'll carry it. I'll go ahead and carry that.
I'm not that fond of it.
Okay, thank you. And so that closes the work session on Senate Bill 68. Let's open the work session on Senate Bill 64.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to, if Mr. Hamrick could come up. I've had quite a few talks or discussions about this bill, and I'd just like to put on the record the issues we've talked about, that we feel we need a definition of what an archaeological investigation is, which would be it's the term used on page 1 of the bill in section 1. Mr. Hammock, I'd just like to have him put on the record that he would agree that we do that is not defined anywhere. We need a definition of what that means. And also, and I think it's going to take a new section in the bill, because 358.915 is not currently part of this bill, but I believe it can be added under the relating to clause. But we have a statute 358.920, which is prohibitive conduct, and they're talking about what people can or can't do on private land and public land. 358.915 is a chapter right in front of that says the provisions of ORS 192.005, 192.501, and 192.505, 273.909, 358.905 to 358.960. Oh, wait a second! I think we just found something. It is included, isn't it?
I just noticed that, Mr. Chairman.
So we don't need to change that statute. Never mind. All we need to do then is is define what archaeological investigation is, and then we'll be fine with the bill.
Okay, and that'll take some amendments, and you'll work with Senator Beyer on those amendments.
Mr. Chairman, James Hamrick, Parks and Rec. Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer and I had a nice chat. I think we are pretty much headed in the same direction.
Okay.
And just to make sure that the public is sort of held harmless when, in fact, there is no criminal activity.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 64, and hopefully we'll get those amendments soon, and then open another work session and pass that out. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 103. We have three people signed up for this, Bob Rindy, Dennis Mulvihill, and Art Schlack. If you could come up and give us the pitch on Senate Bill 103, that would be great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And let's start with Dennis Mulvihill. If you could tell us what this bill is about, that would be great.
So I was going to have the LCD, but that's...
Okay, that's fine.
We've been practicing that out in the hallway.
I don't want to disrupt your finely tuned presentation. Go ahead, Bob.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And this is a bill that our department offered, but it is a redraft of an effort that's been underway for some time and involved many other parties, some of which are in front of you today. I can give you the in a nutshell version, which is that there was an oversight in the drafting of some legislation in the 2001 session that authorized farm worker housing on exclusive farm use zones. We tried mightily last session and just got caught in the crunch at the end of the session to just simply correct that oversight. And we're back again to do the same thing. The statute for exclusive farm use zones is divided, with part of it being for what we call marginal lands counties, and only two counties opted into that when it first came in. And then another statute for all the rest of the counties. And if you look at 215 and ORS 215-283, you'll see that there are many, many pages of almost identical text. And indeed, many, many of the provisions apply equally to both counties. But when the farm worker housing provisions were added to the statute in 2001, they were inadvertently added. They were added to 283, but inadvertently were not added to 213. And so those counties don't have the ability to have this housing in the same way that other counties do. That's the short version. The language it's not easy to see the language and see how we get there. And I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage. As you are well aware, Ron Eber is usually here before you on matters of exclusive farm use statutes. And unfortunately, this was scheduled at a time he had long ago scheduled for vacation, so he can't be here today. Okay. I'm going to try my best to try to answer some of those questions.
Well, I did want to ask, because I don't see how it does what it purports to do. It adds the words primary dwelling. And in several cases, that's the only word that's being inserted is primary dwelling. How does that get us to farmworker housing?
And I was afraid you were going to ask that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I was afraid you were going to ask about the details of the language.
Okay.
This language, of course, has been massaged and been back and forth by a long time and a number of parties, and I wasn't there.
Okay.
I don't know why we arrived at this language,
right,
because I wasn't there.
Well, let's. I think Mr. Schlack is, maybe their answer is calling him. No. No, that's okay. That's okay. But can either one of you enlighten us as to that? How this bill gets us there just by inserting the word primary?
Mr. Chair, Art Schlack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, if you look at the first page of the bill under lines 25 and 26, there is reference there to the primary dwelling. Then there's also other dwellings, okay? But the primary dwelling has to be on the farm parcel, and there's also the reference to accessory dwellings. Well, the accessory dwellings at this point are the farm worker housing that's in conjunction with the farm, and they're accessory to the farm.
Where's the reference to accessory dwelling?
In line 25.
Oh, I see, yes.
Okay, so it is very subtle at this point. And so there's a clarification of where the primary dwelling needs to be. The secondary dwelling then can be on not only where the farm dwelling is, but also can be on other land that is part of the farm operation.
Okay. Senator Atkinson?
Where is the language where it restricts this bill to Lane and Washington counties?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Atkins, again,
Son.
There is marginal land counties.
Son.
Atkins.
Atkinson. I apologize. I've probably been doing that, Senator Atkinson, for years at this point, and again, I apologize. There's different provisions in statute as it relates to 36 counties. The 36 counties. 34 of the counties are covered under ORS 215-283, and the marginal land counties are ORS 215-213. And so this bill changes ORS 215-213 to add these provisions.
Okay. I mean, the other way of saying it, Senator Atkinson, is that when the statute created a provision for marginal land counties, and only two counties opted in to become marginal land counties, Washington and Lane County, and when they did the farm worker housing bill before, they did it for all the other counties, but not the marginalized counties.
So my follow-up question is, just for the record, making sure that my two counties aren't in any way disadvantaged with farm worker housing issues.
Mr. Chairman, Dennis Mulvey of Washington County. What this does is makes marginal land counties have the same provisions of law apply to them as already applies to your county. So your county already has that, and it does not change it. It just adds the two counties that were left out inadvertently in two sessions ago.
Okay. Thank you.
That's any a other? Long way around for explaining something.
A lot of paper for this.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Shields.
Yes. My question, actually, Mr. Chair, is directed at you.
Okay.
And that would be if you would need more information on this, would we be wise to ask legislative counsel to come down and explain line 25 and 26, or are you satisfied?
Well, you're
the lawyer. I mean,
there's the land use lawyer. I'm satisfied that everybody that's looked at this says that that's what it's intended to do, and that's what it in fact does do. It fell through the cracks when they did the farm worker housing for the rest of the state.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I'd like to just clarify that the marginal lands counties, which are Washington and Lane, that they don't have provisions for this type of housing. They don't. They're silent on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, this language. There were provisions put in to 215-283 like these in the 2001 session. So those counties do have the ability to have, all the counties except the marginal land counties have the ability for farm work.
That's counties. Correct, but in the marginal land designation itself, does the marginal land designation have any impact on this type of housing? In other words, it's said that this is inadvertent. And I just wanted the record to be clear that the marginal lands counties aren't in some way different from the other counties in that they already might address this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's correct. I mean, well, this language will make it so that marginal lands counties may have farm worker housing in the same manner as the other counties.
Okay,
that's
so
the intent.
That's what I wanted the record to show, is that the marginal land designation itself didn't somehow impact this type of, oh my God, I just used impact as a verb.
Only in that when they amended the statute, they forgot to put these words in to 213.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, Dennis Mulvihill again. The Farm Bureau said that I could represent that they are also supportive of this.
And is Mr. Schellenberg sitting in the back? Can you nod your head? He salutes. Okay, we're there. Okay, thanks very much. Any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 103 and open a work session on Senate Bill 103.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 103 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I'd like a carrier for the bill, please. Senator Burdick will be the carrier for the bill. Thank you very much. And let's open a public hearing on. Hang on 1 second. Yeah, it's okay. On Senate Bill 281.
281.
All right.
That's
correct. Senator Atkin. And why don't we first let our committee staff introduce this bill, and then we'll hear from this witness.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 281 makes technical changes involving the process by which a county may sell or exchange real estate. It defines the term purchase agreement. It amends ORS Chapter 275 to eliminate general references to contracts to convey property and replaces it with references to purchase agreements. And it changes the terminology in ORS Chapter 275 to delete references to county courts and replace with references to the governing body of the county. This bill is a product of the Real Estate and Land Use section of the Oregon State Bar, which recommends a number of technical changes like this every session.
Okay. Mr. Crane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Crane. I'm an assistant county attorney for Multnomah County, but more significantly for purposes of this bill, I'm also chair of the State Bar Real Estate and Land Use Section, Land Use Legislation Committee, a position I've held the last several sessions. And as the committee administrator mentioned, every session we come forward with several bills that have the consensus of the Real Estate and Land Use Section on things that will be helpful to clean up the real estate practice of law in the state. This bill, in particular, as I discovered when I joined Multnomah County, it turns out counties own a fair amount of property. As the tax assessor, property tax assessor for the state, they foreclose on properties regularly. They also get property by trade, by purchase. There are, and ORS Chapter 275 regulates how counties may dispose of property. Currently, 275.190 allows counties to sell property at auction by cash or by installment contract, and that's it. So, for example, if somebody at auction bids for a property and they come forward and want to give you a down payment, then go out and secure financing from a lender, we can't do that because they have to pay cash or enter into an installment contract, which doesn't make any sense. So another example of problems this poses for counties is we have to enter into an installment contract. We can't take a trust deed, for example. When you buy property or take a mortgage on a piece of property, the bank keeps a trust deed, and if you don't pay the bank, they foreclose on the trust deed. This is the most common mechanism for financing real estate in the state and protecting the lender's interest. Counties can't do that because by statute we can only take or sell property by cash or an installment contract. So what this bill tries to do is allow counties to update that statute and to allow counties, when they dispose of property, to take advantage of all the modern financing mechanisms generally available in the sale of properties today. Trust deeds allow somebody to make a down payment and then go out and get financing. Also, these bills always have a funny story or two behind them. There was a situation in Gillum County not long ago. Property sold at auction. There were two bidders bidding on it. The guy who won came forward, brought out his checkbook and tried to write a check for the property. The other guy said, no, that's not cash. Statute says cash or installment contract. That actually went to the district court, and the judge said, well, we're going to call a check a cash equivalent, close enough, end of story. Please let us update the statute to allow the counties to use modern financing mechanisms when selling property. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. I noticed that the bill also references to, or deletes references to county courts. What's that about?
That is a cleanup, I believe, from a bill that passed some years ago that dealt with, I forget what they were called, where there was a consolidation of local courts into the circuit courts. And this reference was not caught when that measure passed. I believe that was 99.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Crane, there's a book by Eugene Burrell, I think, published by University of Oregon in the 50s called Gold in the Woodpile. Have you ever heard of that book?
I have not.
I would like to carry this bill, and can you help me find a copy of that book since you're a lawyer?
I'm a lawyer, not a librarian, but I think I can find it. Gold in the Woodpile?
I think between the story I want to read on the floor that's out of that book and your interest at the State Bar, I think we have a fantastic story of how the Paiute Indian Reservation was purchased on auction under the same dilemma.
I would be curious to see that book.
gold in the wood pile.
We'll find it. Okay.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Crane. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 281.
I just wondered, is that supposed to be a trailer for his floor speech, or what is?
I think it is. I think it is. I'm sorry. We have one other
promo for a floor speech. Yeah. Okay.
We just closed the public hearing, but we're in work session. Excuse me. Come on up and testify, and you can identify yourself for the record.
My name is Ed Johnson. I really did want to testify on this.
Hi, Ed.
Bill, and I'm going to be doing more writing up on this. This is a horrifying bill. Everybody needs to pay attention to how this will backfire to every citizen in the state of Oregon. I sat 3 weeks ago in a county court where a judge just told a man dealing with this property relating to this bill that the Constitution of the state of Oregon and the United States does not exist, stated in his courtroom. This is a horrifying bill. I want to read something. This treaty does exist in the United States, the Great Northwest Treaty.
Excuse me. You need to slow down a little bit. Do you have written testimony?
No, not on this one. I do not on this direct bill, but I would like to read this treaty on the behalf of...
Why don't you hold up and show me what you're about to read us?
I will give you a copy.
No, that's okay. Just all right.
You have another copy of it. I'll give you a copy of it.
All right, thank you. We're probably not going to read all of this, but...
Well, it needs to go on record, public record. I think it's very important.
Mr. Johnson, excuse me. Just slow down for a minute, okay? Catch your breath.
Yeah.
We can put something on record by document.
Okay. I would much rather publicly state it.
Mr. Johnson, we've got a lot to do. I want you to have your say, but on the other hand, we can't slow down the process too much. Excuse me. So this is what I want you to do. I want you to take a breath, slow down, read the parts of this that you think are most important, all right, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. This is the Great Northwest Treaty done with Great Britain and the tri-states of California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and the southwest corner of Montana. Very important. Landowners prefer this land by the federal land patent. Jurisdiction by any sort, state court is invalid. So, in other words, the states cannot take your property for foreclosing on property taxes or rights to that. No mortgage institute can claim a title to a land by its lien. Certified federal land patents were given free and clear of title of no incumbents, there or now. Lead case in this is treaty law cannot be interfered with by a state legislator in war, by where? WARE versus Hylton, Hylton, in 1976. In other words, the federal land patents put into evidence by an owner cannot be challenged by any state court. And it gets in. Also, too, this does violate the Oregon State Constitution. And I will not read the sections, but I will not read them all, but I will give the sections. Violates Section 1 of the Oregon State Constitution, Section 10 of the Oregon State Constitution, Section 18 of the Oregon State Constitution, Section 19 of the Oregon State Constitution, Section 20 of the Oregon State Constitution. One thing is that, in short, the parliamentary procedure of the system started in 1879, and our system, we adopted that from Great Britain. Like Napoleon said, divide and conquer is a wonderful way of working at it, and that's what we are doing to ourselves. This bill would actually give the rights to the counties. Instead of having defense of any citizen in the state of Oregon, the counties will sit there and determine how property is determined and taken from a citizen, and there will be no court procedures. That's exactly what this bill will do. In other words, your family's property will be challenged and possibly lost because of this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. All right. Committee, we're in a work session. Senator Atkinson, is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we need a carrier for the bill. Senator Atkinson, that's right. Senator Atkinson will carry this bill. And let's open a... Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 96, please. And let's see, there's sign-ups. Okay, why don't you go ahead and introduce the bill for us, committee administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 96 allows the Land Conservation and Development Commission to amend land use planning goals and guidelines after only one public hearing if the change is required by a legislative enactment or a ballot measure. Under current law, LCDC is required to hold at least 10 public hearings and at least two in each congressional district anytime they're considering changes to the planning goals or guidelines. This bill would give them the discretion to only hold one hearing when essentially they're just instituting instructions they've been given by the legislature or by a ballot measure.
Thank you. Bob Rindy, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a fairly simple thing, but it will be important in the event, and it's not frequent, but in the event there is new statutes or even a ballot measure that would, in a sense, conflict with or be inconsistent with the statewide planning goal. Right now, we have to hold 10 hearings around the state. The expense of that is considerable, and we have calculated that from past practice. It cost the department around $114,894 on average to amend a goal just because of all the hearings. And those are, and I want to emphasize that those are, it's a good thing that we do have to have that amount of hearing, that number of hearings around the state, and that all citizens in all different areas have an opportunity to participate and comment when a goal is amended. But if the statute has already spoken, so to speak, and our planning goal is inconsistent, citizens are frustrated. They would come to those hearings. They may have differing points of view, and we would take all that testimony, but then they would hear that the commission has no leeway. They have to change the goal to be consistent with the law. And so for that reason, we are requesting that that part of the statute be amended so that in that eventuality, we can have only one hearing. We could have more, but we would be required to have only one, as is the case for other administrative rules.
Thank you, Mr. Mindy. Can you just give an example of a situation where you had to give those hearings that even though the change had been mandated by either statute or initiative?
Mr. Chair, I did some walking around the department over the last couple of weeks to try to bring those to mind. The times that we have amended a goal due to a statute, there's only been a couple of those. The one that comes to mind and that you're all most aware of is that when the legislature changed provisions for farmland, and I believe that was in 1991. I wasn't doing this job then, but it's my understanding that the commission chose at that time to do things that were far more extensive than were that the statute might have a few words. It's up to the commission to place a lot of detail if they wish to provide counties and cities with more information. I don't have an example of where there has been a change that is so simple that the commission would only want to change the goal in one way and no other ways. There may be some examples. I wasn't able to dredge those up out of our staff. But we are concerned about this because it has occurred in a number of sessions that we've seen legislation that if it had passed, it would have done that. And we are frequently in front of you indicating that a particular piece of legislation would have a fiscal impact of $100,000+ on us because it might require us to change one word in our goal. And that's not something we don't want to be in that position either. And because we've seen it so many times, as I said, it hasn't happened yet. I think it will happen, and we want to be ready for it.
Okay. And the $114,000 figure you get is by taking your hearings to 10 different places around the state and opening it up.
Mr. Chair, it's not only as a result of those hearings. The person who did that calculation looked at the average staff time spent in order to have those hearings and arrange them, attend, travel, etc. There's advertising, a significant amount of advertising cost associated with this.
And that's because before a hearing, you're required to advertise it through the local newspapers?
In newspapers that are of general circulation, that's correct.
Right.
It is mostly staff time. It's also legal time, but the staff time can be considerable to take a goal amendment on the road, set up, arrange hearings around the state, staff those hearings, and take all that testimony.
Might you be having those hearings anyway for other purposes, and if this did arise at some point, you would just schedule those hearings together with other hearings, and so you wouldn't have to have new staff time invested into it?
Mr. Chair, there are times when we can combine things in that way, but it's not common for the commission to amend a goal. It's not frequent that they do so. So yes, if there was a reason at the end of a legislative session to amend several goals, we'd try to combine them all. But I don't know at this point that we would always expect that to happen.
Okay. Thank you, committee.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question. I just have a comment, and that is it kind of goes to the credibility of our whole process here on some of these issues, where if the legislature mandates something and then you go out for a public hearing, I think the public expects that they can have some impact on what is going to happen to that. And if, in fact, the commission has no authority to change the basic thrust of what they're doing, I just think, you know, finances aside, that that's not a good thing to be doing for the credibility of our whole process here.
Thank you. Senator Byer?
This makes me nervous, and I'm trying to figure out, and it makes me nervous because I don't. A lot of the problems, in my opinion, with our land use system is not the statutes. It's the goals and it's the rules. And it was.
Mr. Byer, I thought we just fixed all those problems with Measure 37.
That didn't change any rules,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And I'm trying to figure out how this would work and how it could be. I mean, I could agree if the goals are making this are not more stringent than the statute, but I'm concerned about the other way around. It really makes me nervous to get public out of the process. I'm trying to. You said you don't have a real life case where this happened, but I'm wanting to know if there. Give me a more concrete, I guess, a reason. Point me to a bill that would have required where you couldn't have done something but change a goal and the statute would have mandated it. Can you do that?
I can bring that back to you. I'm trying to, off the top of my head, remember. Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, I know that I can go back and find information on dozens and dozens of fiscal impact statements over the last five sessions that the department has submitted, where we have reported that there is a fiscal to a bill, and it's only because something in that bill would have required a change to our goal, and sometimes a significant change, sometimes a small change. And I can't today give you those, but I know we can find those for you.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I'm uninformed on this because I'm getting rusty in my land use since I left the commission, but with the 80-acre rule on farmland, was that a case where the legislature mandated something and then the commission had to put it in its rules?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, and of course I was not the staff person doing that, but if I may, my recollection is that the work that we did in responding to that legislation was considerable, because that was a very big piece of legislation, had lots of provisions, and I don't think this would have applied there. There was too much to do, and what we instead wrote this for, and I apologize for not bringing you examples today, are the numerous bills we see that will make minor changes or could have smaller changes where there's no question how do we have to amend the goal, and there's no question that we have to amend the goal. And in those instances, we don't want to simply bring to you again and again and again a report of a high fiscal when we know that we're going to change the goal and it's going to be pretty simple to change it.
Okay. To me, I'm open for direction. My sense is to close the public hearing, see if we can reduce Senator Beyer's nervousness, because we don't want him to be nervous. And maybe at the same time, Bob, you can check and see if there are examples where this actually has been a problem, rather than just is something you might be worried about. Is that reasonable?
Mr. Chair, I think we're going to be hard-pressed to find an actual example, but okay. we are responding to the numerous fiscals we've filed on bills that didn't happen.
Maybe you can give us examples of near misses.
We certainly can.
That will convince Senator Beyer this is a good thing to do. Okay, thank you, Bob. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 96. And let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 431. And Bob, if you could come up on this together with Dick Banner, that would be great. And why don't you go ahead and introduce us to the bill, Matt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 431 clarifies the subject matter relating to local governments over which the Land Use Board of Appeals does and does not have jurisdiction. Currently, there are situations where it's not clear whether somebody has to file an appeal with LUBA or with LCDC or with the department.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Banner, why don't we start with you?
Okay. Dick Banner. I represent Metro. I work in the Office of Metro Attorney. At the hearing on this bill, was it last week or the week before, Senator Atkinson was acting as chair, and I think Senator Burdick may have been here, but I'm not sure. At any rate, several of you were not here, so perhaps I should go back over the ground and explain what Senate Bill 431 does and why we support it. Today, if a local government, metro or a city or a county, makes an amendment to a comprehensive plan or a land use regulation and is in periodic review, once the decision is made by the local government submits that decision to LCDC, because LCDC has general jurisdiction over periodic review. If a person has participated in that process at the local government level, that person can then participate at LCDC. That person can also file an appeal of the very same local government decision at LUBA. Once it gets to LUBA, at the same time that it's at LCDC, a question then arises, who has jurisdiction over the argument, to the claim that's being made by the person who's unhappy with the local government decision. So the situation then is, for the same decision, local government has to defend it in two different places. It has to defend it at LCDC and has to defend the decision at the Land Use Board of Appeals. That seems wasteful for citizens, wasteful for the local government, wasteful for state government, which has to subsidize both LUBA and LCDC in the review. And Senate Bill 431 would change that by saying that if the local government decision is made in periodic review, it has to go to LCDC anyway, that's where periodic review goes, then it should only be at LCDC and there should not be an opportunity to appeal it to the Land Use Board of Appeals. Part of the problem that we face today, besides having to go maybe to two different forums, is once you are in two different forums, the issue is who has jurisdiction. This becomes a legal issue. So instead of getting right to the merits of the case, both sides spend a lot of time and a lot of LUBA time arguing about whether LUBA has jurisdiction or LCDC has jurisdiction. That's wasteful as well. So this language that you see in Senate Bill 431 again says if a local government makes a decision that is part of periodic review that automatically has to go to LCDC for review, then it cannot be appealed to LUBA. So any issue that comes up in periodic review, LCDC would review it, And then from LCDC, there's appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
So that's basically it.
Good. Thank you. Committee, any questions? Senator Atkinson, are you on board with this common sense effort to streamline our government system so we can save money?
Philosophically, I think it makes a good point. But my problem with it is that I just get upset when we're trying to make everything easier for government and for government to appeal to government and for government to manage government. And I can tell you of case after case in Southern Oregon where people don't know where to go.
But Senator Atkinson, this is to try to give them guidance where to go.
After they've invested a ton of time, and it's more of philosophical. I think this is a good idea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the frustration we have at home is when you have city, county, LCDC, LUBA, and nobody knows how to navigate all that. So you feel like, you know, the government doesn't want to be in two dual jurisdictions at the same time, but oftentimes citizens feel that they're fighting for and they don't even know the process. I was in a meeting last week. It was actually very productive. Lane Shutterly was fantastic, and so was the regional person. Lane's doing a good job. But at the end of the meeting, it was, you know, the advice that was given to a constituent was, you know, maybe the best thing for you to do is spend money and buy and get a professional land use consultant. So this land use can just, you know, all of a sudden we got good advice. We cleared up some problems, and now my constituent was encouraged by the government to go spend 10 grand on a land use consultant to navigate a system. That's my frustration. So I like to vent my frustration every time it appears that we're making it easier for the government and not for real people.
Yeah, just that.
I want to.
I think is entirely consistent with the frustration that you just expressed. Let me give you an example. When Metro amended its urban growth boundary in 2002, Metro included an area called Bethany that included some farmland. There were some folks who wanted Metro who objected to that. They didn't want Metro to include the farmland. And this is in periodic review. When we were finished with the decision, we sent it to the agency. So put yourself in the shoes then of the citizen who didn't want that to happen. Goes to see a lawyer and says, I wish that Metro hadn't included that farmland. Can you help me out? And the lawyer says, well, let's see. We think that including the farmland violated LCDC's Goal 3. LCDC has jurisdiction over that. We also think that it violated that statute that says bring in farmland last. We're not sure whether LCDC has jurisdiction over that because it's not a goal. It's a statute. So, Ms. Jones, we're going to have to do two things, not one. We can't just go to LCDC. You're also going to have to pay me to file at the Land Use Board of Appeals, where I'm going to have an argument with the lawyer for the agency and spend some more of your money arguing over who has jurisdiction. If you enact Senate Bill 431, that won't happen because the lawyer representing Mrs. Jones can go to LCDC, and that's the only place she has to go.
And in this case, that guy is a constituent of mine named Greg Malinowski, right?
That's correct.
And he's a good farmer in my district who just wants to know how to access government. And this bill would help me do it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I wanted to ask Mr. Benner, this letter that we got from Lane Shetterly said that he wanted us to hold off because of a committee that's going to make a recommendation on February 22nd. Is that still something that he wants us to do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, yes, I know exactly what that letter is about. I haven't seen it, but Bob told me about it. As I mentioned when I was here a week ago or so, this bill, Senate Bill 431, is consistent with a tentative recommendation by that committee. It is a committee that will eventually make a report to you on improvements to the periodic review process. There is one more meeting of that interim committee on periodic review. I believe it's next week. And I think what Mr. Shetterly is asking is to allow that committee to finish its business, have its last meeting, make its final recommendations, and have a discussion about this bill and concerns that the agency may have with it. And at that point, if you would hold on to it until after that meeting, I think it's on the 22nd of February, then you would have the final recommendation from that interim committee. And if there are difficulties with this bill for the department, maybe we can iron them out there.
I guess I kind of assumed you were a member of the periodic committee. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't say that.
Well, that makes me step back a little bit. Now you're telling me the department has some potential problems with this bill?
Well, you should let the representative of the department address that.
Is the answer to that question yes or no?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy, again, with the department. We have heard from the Attorney General's office that we should be concerned, and these were new concerns that were raised to us, and the concerns are described as this. Typically, LCDC does indeed deal with goals and often statutes. Occasionally, and he was able to tick off four recent situations, things that are in periodic review go to LUBA, and they are concerned very complex things such as constitutional issues over city charters, things for which LCDC has no expertise.
Okay, time out. We're gonna go ahead and close this. I don't want to hear more of this right now. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 431. And I just need to know ahead of time if the department has problems with these, particularly if it's the second hearing. And I know I ducked out a little bit for the first hearing, but I don't want to be caught by surprise.
Mr. Chair, I phoned as soon as I heard these, and I've now twice talked to your administrator about our concerns and asked that this be postponed.
All right. Well, let's postpone this. Let's close the we already closed the public hearing, so let's go ahead and adjourn the Senate Committee for the Environment and Land Use. Thanks very much.
Thank you.